is to become fluent with them. The more Daniel and I talked, the more his own statements began to cast doubt on his story. When I asked him on different occasions, 2 weeks apart, to describe what the number 9,412 looked like, he gave me two completely different answers. The first time he said, "There's blue in there because it starts with a 9 and a drifting motion as well, and kind of like a sloping as well." 2 weeks later, he said after a long pause, "It's a spotty number. There's spots and curves as well. It's actually a very complex number." Then he added, "The larger the numbers are, the harder they are to put into words. That's why in interviews I usually concentrate on the smaller numbers." Indeed, synesthetes are never entirely consistent, and to his credit, Daniel described several smaller numbers consistently over the course of our meetings. But what about those mind power and advanced memory skills courses that Daniel used to advertise on the WWBC? Back at his home in Kent, I handed him a printout of his ad from 2001 and asked him what I was supposed to make of it. If his extraordinary memory came to him entirely without effort, and he didn't need to use mnemonic techniques, why was he selling a course on exactly that subject? He uncurled his feet from under him and put them back on the floor. "Look, I was 22 at the time," he said. "I had no money. The one thing I had experience in was competing in the World Memory Championship. So I wrote a course on improving your memory. When I went to the World Championship, I found out that the people taught themselves to remember. None of them had good memories. I thought at the time that they were lying. But it did give me the idea that this was something you could teach. I was in a position where I had to sell myself. The only thing I thought was sellable was my brain. So I used Tony Buzan kind of stuff. I said, 'Expand your brain,' and that sort of thing. But I didn't like doing it." "You don't use memory techniques?" I asked him. "No," he assured me. If Daniel had concocted his story of being a natural savant, it would have required a degree of mendacity that I couldn't quite bring myself to believe he possessed. If he was merely a trained mnemonist trying to cloak himself in the garb of a savant, why would he so willingly subject himself to scientific testing? How could one ever know whether Daniel is what he claims to be? For a long time, scientists were skeptical that synesthesia even existed. They dismissed the phenomenon as fakery, or nothing more than lasting associations made between numbers and colors in childhood. Despite all the case reports in the literature, there was no way of proving that something so seemingly far-fetched was actually taking place in someone's brain. In 1987, Baron Cohen developed a test of genuineness for synesthesia, the first rigorous assessment of the condition. The test measures the consistency with which a purported synesthete reports color-word associations over time. When Baron Cohen administered a version of this test to Daniel, he passed it with ease. Still, I couldn't help but wonder if any trained mnemonist would have been able to do as well. Other results from Daniel's scientific testing struck me as odd. When Baron Cohen tested Daniel's memory for faces, he performed abysmally, leading Baron Cohen to conclude that his face memory appears impaired. That sounds like just the sort of thing a savant might be bad at. And yet when Daniel Corney competed in the World Memory Championship, he won the gold medal in the Names and Faces event. It just didn't make sense. One test that might help demonstrate Daniel's synesthesia more conclusively would be an fMRI scan. In many number-color synesthetes, you can actually see brain areas associated with color processing light up when the subject is asked to read a number. When Baron Cohen teamed up with fMRI experts to look at Daniel's brain, they didn't find this. Their test subject did not activate extrastriate regions normally associated with synesthesia, suggesting that he has an unusual and more abstract and conceptual form of synesthesia, the researchers concluded. Were it not for the fact that he'd passed the test of geniusness for synesthesia, another reasonable conclusion might be that Daniel is not a synesthete at all. Sometimes people ask me if I mind being a guinea pig for the scientists. I have no problem with it because I know that I am helping them to understand the human brain better, which is something that will benefit everyone, Daniel writes in his memoir. It is also gratifying for me to learn more about myself and the way in which my mind works. When Anders Ericsson invited Daniel to visit FSU to be tested according to his own exacting standards, Daniel said he was too busy to make the trip. The problem with all the tests given to Daniel is their null hypothesis, the working assumption that would be true if their alternative hypothesis were proven false, namely, that if Daniel wasn't a savant, then he must be just a regular guy. But what needs to be tested, especially in the light of his unusual personal history, is the alternative possibility that the world's most famous savant might actually be a trained mnemonist. About a year after my first meeting with Daniel, his publicist emailed me to ask if I wanted to meet with him again, this time over breakfast at the stylish Midtown Hotel he was staying at in New York. He was in town to do an appearance on Good Morning America and to promote his book, Born on a Blue Day, which had debuted in America in third place on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. After a cup of coffee and some pleasant chit-chat about his life in the spotlight, I asked him again, for the third time, what the number 9412 looked like to him. There was a flicker of recognition in his eyes before he closed them. He knew I hadn't pulled those digits out of thin air. He put his fingers in his ears and held them there for two very long, uncomfortable minutes of silence. "I can see it in my head, but I can't break it down," he said finally. "Last time I asked, you were able to describe it almost immediately." He thought about it a bit longer. "It would be dark blue, and it would be pointy and shiny with a drifting motion. Or I could picture it as 94 and 12, in which case it would look like a triangle and this sort of shape." He made a kind of quadrilateral with his arms. His face was cherry red. "It depends on all sorts of things, like whether I heard the number okay and how I decided to break it up. It depends on whether I'm tired. I make mistakes sometimes. I see the wrong number. I mistake it for a number that looks similar. That's why I prefer to do tests with actual scientists. There isn't the same stress." I read back to him the descriptions he'd given me of 9412 the last two times I'd seen him. They could hardly have been more different. I told him my theory, which I realized would be very difficult to prove, that he was using the same basic techniques as other mental athletes, and that he invented these far-out synesthetic descriptions of numbers to mask the fact that he had memorized a simple image to associate with each of the two-digit combinations from 00 to 99, one of the most basic techniques in the mnemonist's toolkit. It was one of the most uncomfortable sentences I'd ever spoken to anyone. For some time, I agonized over whether to include Daniel in this book. But late one night, not long before I was supposed to turn in a draft of this chapter, I decided to do one last internet search for his name, just to see if I might have missed something, or at least to refresh my memory about a story that had been sitting in a folder in my filing cabinet for over a year. Somehow, and I don't know how I missed this before, I found a cached version of danieltammet.com, a website created in 2000 that hadn't been online for at least 3 or 4 years. The 7-year-old About page describing Daniel included a surprisingly forthright bit of autobiography that didn't make it into Born on a Blue Day. My own interest in memory and, conversely, memory sport was sparked by my casual acquaintance with a children's book on broad memory concepts for better exam performance at the age of 15. The following year, I passed my GCSEs with some of the year's best results and subsequently performed well at A-level, mastering French and German along the way with the help of these tried and tested techniques. My obsession with the sport grew, and following months of strenuous training and hard work, I climbed into the world's top 5 rated memory sportsmen. Earlier, I had also found something else. A series of messages posted several years ago from the same email address used by Daniel Corney, but sent by someone named Daniel Anderson, who claimed to be a well-respected and gifted psychic with more than 20 years of experience helping and empowering others. The messages explained that Daniel Anderson had received his psychic powers during a series of childhood seizures. There was a link to a website where you could arrange a phone reading with Daniel for advice on all manner of topics, including relationship problems, health and financial matters, lost love, and contacting those who have passed over. I asked Daniel what I was supposed to make of those emails. 6 years ago, he was claiming that his epileptic seizures gave him psychic powers. Now he was claiming that they'd made him a savant. "Do you see why someone might be suspicious?" I asked. He paused to collect himself.
"God, this is embarrassing," he said.
After I offered myself as a tutor, and that wasn't successful, I read an ad for someone who could do psychic readings. You could work from home and use the telephone. That was ideal for me. I wasn't a psychic. I did it for about a year because I had no income otherwise. I was regularly told off because I wasn't giving advice. I was mostly just listening. I treated it, start to finish, only as an opportunity to listen to people. With hindsight, I wish I hadn't done that work, but I was desperate. Look, life is complex. I never thought I would come into the public eye. I promise you that I've done tests for consistency with scientists who are well-placed to determine whether I'm putting it on. And their opinion, not just one scientist's opinion, crucially, is that I'm for real. Toward the end of our final meeting, I told Daniel all the reasons I couldn't bring myself to believe that he, the world's most famous savant, was truly a savant. "I want to be convinced," I told him, "but I'm not. If I wanted to trick you, if I wanted to pull the wool over your eyes, I would practice immensely," he said frankly. "I would come out all guns blazing. I would jump through every hoop. But I sincerely don't care what you think about me. I don't mean that in a personal way. I mean that I don't care what anybody thinks about me. I know myself. I know what goes on in my head when I close my eyes. I know what numbers mean to me. These things are hard to explain and hard to put into terms you can easily analyze. If I was some very good person at defending something, then I would think very carefully and make some great impression on you and everyone else." "You have made a great impression on everyone else." "People trust scientists, and scientists have studied me, and I trust scientists. They're neutral. They're not media. They're not interested in writing a particular angle. They're interested in truth. With media, I am just who I am. Sometimes I come across very well, other times I will be more nervous, and I won't make such a good impression. I'm human. I'm inconsistent because I'm human. Of all the people who've interviewed me, you have treated me the most like a normal person. You've not idolized me. You've treated me on your level. I respect that. I feel more comfortable being a human than being an angel." "That may be because I suspect you are just a normal person," I said. As those words came out of my mouth, I realized I didn't really mean them. What frustrated me about Daniel was that I knew he wasn't normal.
In fact, the one thing I know I can say for certain about him is that he is exceptionally bright. I know how much work it takes to train one's memory. Anyone can do it, but not just anyone can do it to the degree that I suspected Daniel had. I believed Daniel was special. I just wasn't sure he was special in the way he was claiming. I asked Daniel if, when he looked at himself in the mirror, honestly, he really considered himself a savant. Am I a savant? He put down his coffee and leaned in close. It all depends on how you define the word, doesn't it? You could define savant in such a way that I would be excluded from the definition. You could define it in such a way that Kim Peek would be excluded from the definition. And you could define it in such a way that there would be no more savants in the world at all. It all comes down to definitions. In his book, Extraordinary People, Treffert defines savant syndrome as an exceedingly rare condition in which persons with serious mental handicaps have spectacular islands of ability or brilliance which stand in stark, markedly incongruous contrast to the handicap. According to that definition, the question of whether Daniel uses memory techniques would be irrelevant to whether he is a savant. All that matters is that he has a history of a developmental disability and can perform phenomenal mental feats. According to Treffert's definition, Daniel would indeed be a prodigious savant, albeit one whose disability is less pronounced. However, what Treffert's definition does not capture is the clear difference between someone like Kim Peek, whose incredible abilities are apparently unconscious and perhaps even automatic, and someone who achieves those same skills through tedious, methodical training. As late as the 19th century, the term savant had an entirely different connotation than it has today. It was the highest epithet that could be bestowed on a man of learning. A savant was someone who had mastered multiple fields, who traded in abstract ideas, who consecrated their energies to the search for truth, as Charles Richer, the author of the 1927 book The Natural History of a Savant, put it. The term had nothing to do with singular abilities or a prodigious memory. And yet over the last century, the word's meaning has changed. In 1887, John Langdon Down, better known for the chromosomal disorder that bears his name, coined the term idiot savant. The word idiot, regarded as politically incorrect, eventually fell away. In a world in which our everyday memories have atrophied and we've become totally estranged from the idea of a disciplined memory, savant has gone from being a term of art and an emblem of intellectual accomplishment to being a freakish condition, a syndrome. You'd never hear a polymath like Oliver Sacks described as a savant today, though he, as much as anyone, meets the dictionary definition. Today, the word is reserved for people like the autistic twins that Sacks famously wrote about, who were supposedly able to count 111 matches the instant they spilled onto the floor. So what about someone like Daniel? One of the oldest myths about savants is that they were destined to be born into this world as geniuses, but by some terrible twist of fate, had all of their aptitudes curtailed but one. I wondered about Daniel. I wondered what we would say about him if he was just a guy who had trained himself to memorize 22,000 digits of pi and to multiply three-digit numbers in his head. I wonder what we'd say if he'd achieved those things only through rigorous discipline and enormous effort. Would that make him more incredible than Kim Peek, or less? We want to believe that there are Daniel Tammets walking among us, individuals born into this world with extraordinary talents in the face of extraordinary difficulties. It is one of the most inspiring ideas about the human mind. But perhaps Daniel exemplifies an even more inspiring idea, that we all have remarkable capacities asleep inside of us, if only we bothered ourselves to awaken them. Chapter 11. The U.S. Memory Championship.
There was to be a new event at the 2006 U.S. Memory Championship, one never before experienced in the history of memory competitions. It was clunkily called Three Strikes and You're Out of the Tea Party, and it had been dreamed up specifically to please the producers from HDNet, the cable network that would, for the first time ever, be airing the contest on national television. Five strangers, posing as guests at a tea party, would walk onto the stage and tell the competitors 10 pieces of information about themselves: their addresses, phone numbers, hobbies, birthdays, favorite foods, pets' names, and make and model of their cars, etc. It was a test as true to the demands of real life as there had ever been in a memory contest. I had no idea how I would prepare for it, and frankly, I hadn't thought much about it until just a month and a half before the contest, when Ed and I spent a pair of evenings on a transatlantic telephone call, inventing a system that would allow me to quickly and easily file away all of that personal information in a specially designed memory palace set aside for each of the strangers. I had constructed five imaginary buildings, one for each of the tea party guests. Each was built in a different style, but with a similar floor plan based around a central atrium and satellite rooms. The first palace was a modernist glass cube in the manner of Philip Johnson's Glass House. The second was a turreted Queen Anne of the type you see all over San Francisco, with lots of frilly scrollwork and ostentatious ornamentation. The third was Frank Gehry-esque, with wavy titanium walls and warped windows. The fourth was based on Thomas Jefferson's red brick home, Monticello. And there was nothing special about the fifth, except that all the walls were painted bright blue. Each home's kitchen would serve as the repository of an address. Each home's den would hold a phone number. The master bedroom was for hobbies, the bathroom was for birthdays, and so on. 3 weeks before the contest, after reviewing the scores I'd been sending him, Ed phoned to tell me that I needed to stop practicing all other events and begin focusing exclusively on the tea party. I rounded up friends and family and had them make up fictional biographies for me to memorize in my painstakingly appointed new palaces. Several unromantic dinners with my girlfriend were spent with her in character, telling me stories about her life as a Nebraska farmer, or a suburban housewife, or a Parisian seamstress, which I then recalled for her over dessert. Then, 1 week before the championship, just at the moment when I wanted to be training hardest, Ed told me I had to stop. Mental athletes always halt their training a week before contests in order to do a spring cleaning of their memory palaces. They walk through them and mentally empty them of any lingering images, because in the heat of competition, the last thing you want to do is accidentally remember something you memorized last week. Some competitors, when they get to a really high level, will not speak to anyone 3 days before a contest, Tony Buzan told me. They feel that any association that enters their head could interfere with associations they form in the contest. The plan had always been for Ed to be ringside at the U.S. Championship. But shortly before the contest, he shipped off to Australia, where he'd been offered a unique opportunity to do philosophy research at the University of Sydney on the phenomenological issues raised by the sport of cricket. He believes that the sport contains even better examples than chicken sexers or chess grandmasters to illuminate his thesis that our immediate perception of the world is powerfully shaped by memory. Suddenly, it was no longer certain that he would be able to make the much longer and more expensive trip from the other side of the earth. "Is there any way I can mediate your disgust at my potential non-appearance?" he asked in an email a couple days before the contest. The emotion I was feeling was not so much disgust as panic. Though I told everyone I knew that I was approaching the contest as little more than a whim, a strange way to spend a weekend morning, was how I put it to a friend. The jokes I sometimes made at the expense of this kooky contest concealed the truth that I was dead set on victory. Ed's last-minute decision to stay in Australia meant that I was on my own to worry about the other competitors, to speculate on how intensely they'd trained over the last year, and to wonder whether any of them were preparing to surprise us by unveiling a new technique that would take the sport to a level I could not reach. There was Ram Kohli, the cheery and insouciant defending champ, who I knew was the most natural talent of the group. If he had decided to train as hard as a European, the rest of us wouldn't have a chance. But somehow, I doubted he had it in him. Mostly, I fretted about Maurice Stoll. If anyone might have committed the time to developing a Millennium PAO system like Ed's, or a 2704 image card system like Ben's, I suspected it would be Maurice. The evening before the championship, Ed emailed me one last piece of advice. All you have to do is to savor the images and really enjoy them. So long as you're surprising yourself with their lively goodness, you'll do just fine. Don't at any stage worry. Take it easy. Ignore the opposition. Have fun. I'm proud of you already. And remember, girls dig scars, and glory lasts forever. That night, I lay in bed obsessively marching through each of my palaces, first forward and then backward, and worrying about Maurice. I couldn't sleep, which, as Maurice himself had observed at the previous year's competition, is for a mental athlete like breaking your leg before a soccer match. When I finally did get to sleep sometime around 3 a.m., with the assistance of some Tylenol PM, I had a terrifying dream in which Danny DeVito and Rhea Perlman, my king and queen of spades, were riding around a parking garage for hours on a pony, the seven of spades, trying in vain to find where they'd parked their Lamborghini Countach, the jack of hearts. Eventually, they and their horse melted into the asphalt, while Maurice Stoll looked on with a sinister Dr. Mengele cackle. I got up 4 hours later, bleary and dazed, and accidentally shampooed my hair twice, an ominous portent if ever there was one. The first person I ran into when I got off the elevator on the 19th floor of the Con Edison headquarters was Ben Pridmore. He had flown in from England for the weekend solely to scout out the American field. At the airport in Manchester, he had splurged on a last-minute first-class upgrade. "What else have I got to waste my money on?" he asked me. I looked down at his half-eaten leather shoes, whose soles were now almost entirely detached. "Good point," I said. "The first event hasn't even started, and I've already lost," I told Ben. I explained about my insomnia and my redundant shampooing, and he seemed convinced that I had done myself no favors with those sleeping pills, whose chemicals, he said, were probably still swimming around in my bloodstream. I downed 2 tall cups of coffee, and in truth, felt more jittery than tired. Mostly, I just felt stupid for having so catastrophically screwed up the most important thing I needed to do in order to be competitive. Meanwhile, Maurice walked in wearing a Texas A&M Aggies baseball cap and a paisley shirt, looking far perkier than he had last year, and frighteningly confident. He recognized me from across the room and strode straight over to shake my hand and introduce himself to the legendary Ben Pridmore. "You're back," Maurice said to me. It was an assertion, not a question. To the extent that I had a strategy, it was to sneak up on Maurice and surprise him. But apparently he'd already been briefed on me. Somebody must have informed him that I'd been training with Ed Cook. "Yeah, I thought I'd try competing this year," I said nonchalantly, and pointed down at my name tag, which read, "Joshua Four, Mental Athlete." "It's kind of like a journalistic experiment." I asked, "How are your numbers looking this year?" I was probing him to see if he'd upgraded his system. "They're good. And yours?" "Good. What about cards?" "Not bad. You?" "I should be all right in cards," I said. "Still using the same systems as last year?" He shrugged a non-reply and asked me, "How did you sleep last night?" "What? How did you sleep?" Why was he asking me that? How did he know about my insomnia? What kind of head games was Maurice trying to play? Remember, last year I didn't sleep so good, he continued.
Yeah, I remember that. And this year?
This year I slept just fine.
Josh needed sleeping pills, said Ben helpfully.
Yeah. Well, they're basically a placebo, right?
I tried to take sleeping pills one time in practice, and I fell asleep the next morning memorizing numbers, said Maurice. You know, lack of sleep is the enemy of memory.
Oh.
Anyway, good luck today.
Yeah, good luck to you too.
New this year was the gaggle of TV cameras buzzing about the room, and the play-by-play analysts, the boxing announcer Kenny Rice and his color man, the four-time U.S. champ Scott Hagwood, perched in front of the stage on director's chairs. Their presence lent the contest the surreal quality of a mockumentary. Did I really just hear Rice describe the contestants as having taken mental prowess to a whole new level? Unlike the international competitions I'd been to, where competitors spent the moments before a contest isolated between a pair of earmuffs or juggling to warm up their brains, the U.S. competitors all milled about making small talk, as if they were about to take a test no more demanding than an eye exam. I sequestered myself in a corner, inserted my earplugs, and tried to clear my mind like a proper European mnemonist. Tony Dottino, a slim, silver-haired and mustachioed 58-year-old corporate management consultant, stood at the front of the room to introduce the contest. Dottino founded the U.S. Memory Championship in 1997 and has run 13 of them ever since. He is one of Tony Buzan's American disciples. Dottino makes his living consulting with companies like IBM, British Airways, and Con Edison, hence the unlikely location of the championship, about how their workforces can be made more productive through the use of memory techniques. You are the folks telling people in our country that memory is not for geeks, he declared. You will be the models that people will come to follow. We're like little infants in terms of writing the history of these events. You, he pointed at us with both index fingers, are writing the history books. I tuned out for the rest of his speech, put my earplugs back in, and took one last walk through each of my palaces. I was checking, as Ed had once taught me, to make sure all of the windows were open and good afternoon sunlight was streaming in, so that my images would be as clear as possible. Among those of us who would contribute to writing the history books were 36 mental athletes from 10 states, including a Lutheran minister from Wisconsin named T. Michael Hardy, about a half dozen kids from Raymond Matthews' talented 10th, and a 47-year-old professional memory trainer from Richmond, Virginia, named Paul Meller, who had run a marathon in each of the 50 states and had been in New Jersey the previous week teaching police officers how to quickly memorize license plate numbers. The big guns were all put behind desks in the back row. These were the folks that Dottino had predicted might make a run at the title. I was flattered to be counted among them, albeit in the last seat at the end of the row. Dottino and I had spoken several times over the previous year, and I'd kept him updated on my practice scores, so he knew I had a sporting chance. The lineup included a compact 30-year-old software engineer from San Francisco named Chester Santos, who goes by the nom de guerre Iceman, which hardly befits his soft-spoken, aw shucks manner. He'd finished in third place the previous year. I had a strong suspicion that Chester didn't like me very much. After I'd written my original article for Slate about the previous year's U.S. championship, I was forwarded an email he'd penned to Tony Dottino. In it, Chester complained that my piece was horrible because I had made Lucas and Ed sound awesome, while the U.S. competitors came off as complete amateurs and slackers. That I now had the impudence to go head-to-head with him after just a year's training must have seemed like the ultimate insult. From the sidelines, I heard Kenny Rice say, "It must be intimidating, much like the weekend athlete who wants to take on LeBron James in a game of one-on-one."
I figured he was talking about me.
Though every other national memory championship in the world is sewn together from approximately the same standard set of events, according to the same standard set of rules established by the World Memory Sport Council, the United States does things slightly differently. In the international events, everyone's scores are added up at the end of the tournament to determine the winner. But the U.S. championship is less straightforward. It consists of a preliminary morning round of four classic pen and paper disciplines, names and faces, speed numbers, speed cards, and the poem, that are used to select six finalists. Those six finalists then compete in the afternoon in three unique television-friendly elimination events called Words to Remember, Three Strikes and You're Out of the Tea Party, and Double Deck or Bust, which whittle the field down until there is only one United States memory champion left standing. The first event of the morning was Names and Faces, which I'd always done pretty well with in practice. The point of the game is to take a packet of 99 headshots and memorize the first and last name associated with each of them. One does that by dreaming up an unforgettable image that links the face to the name. Take, for example, Edward Bedford, one of the 99 names that we had to remember. He was a black man with a goatee, a receding hairline, tinted sunglasses, and an earring in his left ear. To connect that face to that name, I tried to visualize Edward Bedford lying on the bed of a Ford truck. Then, deciding that wasn't distinctive enough, I saw him fording a river on a floating bed. To remember that his first name was Edward, I put Edward Scissorhands on the bed with him, shredding the mattress as he paddled it across the river. I used a different trick to remember Sean Kirk, a white guy with a mullet, sideburns, and the cockeyed smile of a stroke victim. I paired him up with the Fox News anchor Sean Hannity and Captain Kirk of the Starship Enterprise and painted an image in my mind of the three of them forming a human pyramid. After 15 minutes of the contestants staring at those names and faces, a judge came by and picked up our packets and handed us a new bunch of stapled pages with the same set of faces arranged in a different order, and this time with no names attached. We had 15 minutes to recall as many of them as possible. When I put down my pen and handed in my recall sheet, I assumed my score was going to be somewhere near the middle of the pack. The names of Sean Kirk and Edward Bedford had come right back to me, but I'd blanked on the cute blonde and the toddler with the French-sounding name, and a handful of others, so it was hard to imagine I'd done all that well. To my surprise, the 107 first and last names I was able to recall were good enough for a third-place finish, just behind Ram Kohli, who memorized 115, and just ahead of Maurice Stoll, who did 104. The winner of the event was a 17-year-old competitive swimmer from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, named Erin Hope Lully, who'd managed an impressive 124 names, a new U.S. record, and a score that would have gotten a nod of respect even from the top Europeans. When her number was announced, she stood up and waved sheepishly. I looked over at Ram and caught him looking back at me. He lifted his eyebrows as if to say, "Where'd she come from?" The second event of the morning was speed numbers, always my worst. This was the one event where Ed's coaching had given me little advantage, because I had largely ignored Ed's coaching. He had been prodding me for months to develop a more complicated system for numbers, not quite the 64-gun man of war Millennium PAO system he had spent months working on, but something at least a step ahead of the simple major system that most of the other Americans would be using. I'd indulged him and developed a PAO system for all 52 playing cards, but I never got around to doing the same for every two-digit combination from 00 to 99. Employing the same major system as the rest of the mental athletes, I used my 5 minutes of memorization time to go for what I figured was a very safe 94 digits, mediocre even by American standards. And still I managed to get the 88th digit mixed up. Instead of Bill Cosby, I should have seen a family playing an oversized version of Milton Bradley's Game of Life.
I blamed my poor showing on Maurice, whom I had heard even through my earmuffs gruffly yelling, "Enough with the pictures already," at a press photographer who was circulating in the room. Still, my 87 digits left me in fifth place. Maurice had banked 148, a new U.S. record, and Ram had finished in second with 124. Aaron was way down in 11th place, having remembered just 52 digits. I got up, stretched, and had a third cup of coffee. "They're known as MAs, or mental athletes," I heard Kenny Rice earnestly tell the camera. "But at this point in the competition, MA could stand for something else. Mental anguish." Though I'd been operating with inferior mnemonotechnics in the numbers event, when it came to speed cards, the next challenge, I was the only competitor armed with what Ed referred to as the latest European weaponry. Most of the Americans were still placing a single card in each locus, and even the guys who'd been competing for years, like Ram and Iceman Chester, were at best turning two cards into a single image. In fact, only a couple of years ago, it was entirely unheard of for anyone to be able to memorize a whole pack of cards at the U.S. Championship. Thanks to Ed, the PAO system I was using packed three cards into a single image, which meant that it was at least 50% more efficient than what was being used by any of the other Americans. It was a huge advantage. Even if Maurice, Chester, and Ram were going to wipe me in the other disciplines, I hoped I might be able to run up my score in speed cards. Each competitor was assigned an individual judge with a stopwatch, who took a seat across the table. Mine was a middle-aged woman, who smiled as she sat down and said something that I couldn't make out through my earplugs and earmuffs. I had brought along my black spray-painted memory goggles for speed cards, and up until the moment a freshly shuffled deck was placed on the desk in front of me, I was still weighing whether to put them on. I hadn't practiced without my goggles in weeks, and the Con Edison auditorium was certainly full of distractions. But there were also three television cameras circulating in the room. As one of them zoomed in for a close-up of my face, I thought of all the people I knew who might end up watching the broadcast. High school classmates I hadn't seen in years, friends who had no idea about my memory obsession, my girlfriend's parents. What would they think if they turned on their TVs and saw me wearing huge black safety goggles and earmuffs, thumbing through a deck of playing cards? In the end, my fear of public embarrassment trumped my competitive instincts, and I left the goggles on the floor by my feet. From the front of the room, the chief arbiter, a former Marine drill sergeant, shouted, "Go!" My judge clicked her stopwatch, and I began peeling through the pack as fast as I could, flicking three cards at a time off the top of the deck and into my right hand. I was storing the images in the memory palace I knew better than any other, the house in Washington, D.C. that I'd lived in since I was 4 years old, the same house I'd used to remember Ed's to-do list on the rock in Central Park. At the front door, I saw my friend Liz vivisecting a pig. Two of hearts, two of diamonds, three of hearts. Just inside, the Incredible Hulk rode a stationary bike, while a pair of oversized loopy earrings weighed down his earlobes. Three of clubs, seven of diamonds, jack of spades. Next to the mirror at the bottom of the stairs, Terry Bradshaw balanced on a wheelchair. Seven of hearts, nine of diamonds, eight of hearts. And just behind him, a midget jockey in a sombrero parachuted from an airplane with an umbrella. Seven of spades, eight of diamonds, four of clubs. Halfway through the deck, Maurice's Teutonic wail once again penetrated my earmuffs. "No walking!" I heard him yell, presumably at another photographer. This time, I didn't let it break my focus. In my brother's bedroom, I saw my friend Ben urinating on Benedict XVI's papal skullcap. 10 of diamonds, 2 of clubs, 6 of diamonds. Jerry Seinfeld sprawled out bleeding on the hood of a Lamborghini in the hallway. 5 of hearts, ace of diamonds, jack of hearts. And at the foot of my parents' bedroom door, myself moonwalking with Einstein. 4 of spades, king of hearts, 3 of diamonds. The art of speed cards is in finding the perfect balance between moving quickly and forming detailed images. You want to catch just enough of a glimpse of your images so as to be able to reconstruct them later, without wasting precious time conjuring up any more color than necessary. When I put my palms back down on the table to stop the clock, I knew that I'd hit a sweet spot in that balance. But I didn't yet know how sweet. The judge, who was sitting opposite me, flashed me the time on her stopwatch. 1:40. Not only was that better than anything I'd ever done in practice, but I also immediately recognized that it would shatter the old United States record of 1:55. I closed my eyes, put my head down on the table, whispered an expletive to myself, and took a second to dwell on the fact that I had possibly just done something, however geeky, however trivial, better than it had ever been done by anyone in the entire United States of America. I looked up and quickly glanced over at Maurice Stoll, who was stroking his goatee and seemed agitated, and I felt an unseemly satisfaction in the trouble he seemed to be having. Then I looked over at Chester and got nervous. He was smirking confidently. He shouldn't have been. He had clocked in at a lethargic 2:15. By the standards of the international memory circuit, where 30 seconds is the best time, my 1:40 would have been considered middling, the equivalent of a 5-minute mile for any of the serious Europeans. But we weren't in Europe. As word of my time traveled across the room, cameras and spectators began to assemble around my desk. The judge pulled out a second unshuffled deck of playing cards and pushed them across the table to me. My task now was to rearrange the unshuffled pack to match the one I'd just memorized. I fanned the unshuffled deck out across the table, took a deep breath, and walked through my palace one more time. I could see all the images perched exactly where I'd left them, except for two. They should have been in the shower, dripping wet, but all I could spy were blank beige tiles. "I can't see it," I whispered to myself frantically. "I can't see it." I ran through every single one of my images as fast as I could. Had I forgotten a giant pair of toes? A fop wearing an ascot? Pamela Anderson's rack? The Lucky Charms leprechaun? An army of turbaned Sikhs? No, 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 no! I began sliding the cards I did remember around with my index finger. In the top left corner of the desk, I put my friend Liz and her dead pig. Next to her, the Hulk on his bike, and Terry Bradshaw with his wheelchair. As the clock ran out on my 5 minutes of recall time, I was left with 3 cards still on the table. They were the 3 cards that had disappeared from the shower. The King of Diamonds, 4 of Hearts, and 7 of Clubs. Bill Clinton copulating with a basketball. How could I have possibly missed it? I quickly neatened up the stack of cards into a square pile, shoved them back across the table to the judge, and removed my earmuffs and earplugs. I had it nailed. There wasn't a doubt in my mind. After waiting a moment for one of the television cameras to circle around for a better angle, the judge began flipping the cards over one by one, while for dramatic effect, I did the same with the deck I'd memorized. 2 of Hearts, 2 of Hearts, 2 of Diamonds, 2 of Diamonds, 3 of Hearts, 3 of Hearts. Card by card, each one matched. When we got to the end of the decks, I threw the last card down on the table and looked up with a wide, stupid grin that I tried and failed to squelch. I was the new U.S. record holder in speed cards. The throng that had gathered around my desk applauded loudly. One person hooted. Ben Pridmore pumped his fist. A 12-year-old boy stepped forward, handed me a pen, and asked for my autograph. For reasons that were never made clear, it had been decided that the top 3 finishers in the first 3 events of the morning would be given a bye and wouldn't have to compete in the final preliminary event of the morning, the poem. Despite my low score in numbers, My record performance with the cards was enough to leave me in second place overall, behind Maurice and ahead of Iceman Chester. We were all going straight to the quarterfinals. The three of us left the competition hall with Ben Pridmore and walked over to the Con Edison cafeteria, where we sat at the same table eating a cordial and mostly silent lunch. When we returned, the three of us were joined on the stage by Ram, the 47-year-old 50-state marathoner Paul Meller, and 17-year-old Erin Lulley, who had set a new United States record, her second of the day, in the poetry event while we were out of the room. Now that there were only six of us left, the competition shifted to its second phase, designed to amp up the drama for the benefit of the television cameras. Nifty 3D graphics were now projected onto a screen in the front of the room, and theatrical lighting poured down on the stage, where there were six tall director's chairs for us to sit on, each with a lapel microphone resting on it. The first event of the afternoon was Random Words. In a typical Random Words event at a typical national championship, the competitors would have 15 minutes to memorize as many words as possible from a list of 400, then a short break, and then 30 minutes to write as many as they could remember in order on a sheet of paper. It's not exactly a spectator sport. For the U.S. championship, it was decided that everything would happen on stage, with the hope that this might lend the event some of the hand-wringing, agonizing screams, and other kabuki antics that made the spelling bee such compelling theater. The six of us were to go in a circle, one by one, each calling out the next word on the list we'd memorized. The first two mental athletes to miss a word would be knocked out. The list was a collection of concrete nouns and verbs, like reptile and drown, which are the easiest to visualize, mixed in with a few harder-to-imagine abstract words like pity and grace. Whereas your objective in a normal random words event would be to memorize as much as possible and perhaps be a little reckless about it for the sake of packing your memory palace to capacity, Ed and I had reckoned that the rules of the U.S. championship meant that a wiser strategy was to memorize fewer words. I went for a mere 120, but make sure they were 100% right. We figured most of the people on the stage could probably remember more words than me, but also that somebody was going to freak out and try for more than he or she could handle. I would not be that guy. After our 15 minutes of memorizing, we went person by person across the stage announcing the next word from the list. Sarcasm, icon, awning, lasso, torment. When we got to the 27th word, Erin, who had just that morning memorized more poetry than any American mental athlete ever before, floundered. The word was numb. The other five of us all knew it, but for some reason she couldn't see it. She collapsed back into her chair, shaking her head. Nine words later, Paul Meller mistook operation for operate, a classic rookie error. Most of us, and especially the producer from HDNet, which was televising the scintillating proceedings, had been braced for a bruising battle of attrition past at least the 100th word. It was hard to figure out how the event could have ended so early. Even someone who had just learned the principle of the memory palace is usually able to memorize at least 30 or 40 words on a first attempt. I suspected that both Erin and Paul had misjudged the rest of the field and overreached, which meant Ram, Chester, Maurice, and I had slid into the final four on the unforced errors of others. Which meant I was one tea party away from the finals of the U.S. Memory Championship. A tall brunette in a summer dress walked onto the stage and introduced herself. "Hi, I'm Diana Marie Anderson. I was born on December 22, 1967, in Ithaca, New York, 14850. My work number, but please don't call me there, is 929-244-6735, extension 14. I have a pet, and her name is Karma, and she's a yellow lab. I have some hobbies: watching movies, cycling, and knitting. My favorite car is a 1927 Model T Ford. It's black. When I eat, I have pizza and jelly beans and peppermint stick ice cream." While she spoke, Ram, Chester, Maurice, and I had our eyes closed, furiously painting images in our memory palaces. Diana's birthday, 12/22/67, became a one-ton weight, 12, crushing a nun, 22, as she drank a fruit shake, 67, which I placed in a freestanding claw-toothed bathtub in the bathroom of my Victorian palace. For her birthplace and zip code, I walked over to the linen closet and imagined a monster truck tire, 14, rolling over the ledge of one of Ithaca's famous gorges and landing on a couple of fellas, 850. Four more tea party guests appeared on stage and read off equally exhaustive biographies. The contest was called Three Strikes and You're Out, which meant that the first two contestants to forget three pieces of information would be eliminated. After giving us a few minutes for the curve of forgetting to work its magic, the five tea party guests came back on stage and started quizzing us about themselves. First, we were asked for the name of a young woman with blonde hair and a baseball cap, the fourth of the five guests. Chester, sitting at the end of the row, knew it. Susan Lana Jones. Maurice was then quizzed on her date of birth, which he didn't know, and which made me wonder if he hadn't been bluffing about his good night's sleep. One strike for Maurice. Fortunately, I did know her birthday. I pulled it out of the stark marble sink of my modernist palace. It was December 10th, 1975. Ram knew her place of residence, North Miami Beach, Florida, 33180. But Chester couldn't remember her phone number. One strike for Chester. And neither could Maurice. Two strikes for Maurice. The camera zoomed in on me, waiting for me to call out the 10 digits plus extensions. I didn't even try to remember her phone number, I said, looking straight into the lens. My strategy had been to focus on everything else and just hope that those long numbers would be someone else's problem. One strike for Josh. The game continued like this until it got back to Maurice, who couldn't come up with even a single one of the woman's three hobbies. In fact, he might as well have been taking a nap while they'd been reading off their bios. He had three strikes. He was out. The other three of us remained on stage, volleying biographical details back and forth for several more rounds. Eventually, it came back to Chester to recite the work phone number of one of the tea party guests, including the area code and three-digit extension. Chester grimaced and looked down. Why do I always get the phone numbers? Are you kidding me? That's just the way it worked out, said Tony Dottino, who was standing behind a podium at stage left, acting as game show host. Come on, nobody knows the phone numbers. You're a numbers guru, Chester. If I'd been sitting in Chester's chair, I wouldn't have known it either. It was dumb luck that Chester had ended up in that seat and not me. Dumb luck that he got his third strike before me. And dumb luck that I was now on my way to the finals of the U.S. Memory Championship. A 10-minute pause was announced before the final event, double deck or bust, in which Ram and I would each have 5 minutes to memorize the same two decks of playing cards. Maurice grabbed me as I walked off the stage and put his arm around my shoulder. You are the winner, he said in clipped English. Ram cannot do two decks, it is certain. I thanked him curtly and tried to make my way through the crowd to get out of the room. Ben greeted me at the bottom of the stairs with an outstretched palm waiting for a low five. Cards are Ram's worst event, he said excitedly. You've got it in the bag now. Come on, man, what are you trying to do, jinx this? All you've got to do is half of what you did this morning. Please don't say that. You're bringing down some serious evil eye over here. He apologized and left to find Ram to offer him his best wishes. From the sideline, Kenny Rice continued his play-by-play analysis. We are nearing the deciding moment here in the U.S. National Memory Championship. Ram Coley won this event last year. Can the 25-year-old from Virginia pull off the repeat? Or will it be the newcomer Joshua Four, the internet journalist who has covered the event before? Now he's here trying to win it. This last event, double deck or bust, is a mind-against-mind battle. I knew, despite the bad karma, that Ben and Maurice were right. Ram could barely memorize a single deck of cards in 5 minutes, much less two.